So in thinking about the philosophy of evolution, it's important for us to recognize that in the 20th century, soon after Darwin's theory was well digested, there started to be theories of human evolution. And human evolution is primarily the evolution of the mind, mental evolution. And so then the fields of anthropology and psychology really exploded. And so when we need to start now to think about the evolution of consciousness. Because the human being hasn't changed much in 40,000 years, according to most physicalist, biological theories. The human being is changing very gradually, no doubt, like everything else. And the reality is constant, gradual change.
There was one lady that came, that French lady, that did a presentation on how the jaw is getting narrower and narrower. Well, some people are studying minutely the fact that kids are having more and more dental problems because the jaw is getting narrower.
So that the brain can get larger.
Yeah.
Well, it's not necessarily so bad, but
that's what he said.
Anyway, it was interesting.
But yeah, it has been shown that there is a correspondence, and Darwin calls this co-evolution or co-adaptation of parts. So when one changes, the other one changes automatically, and not necessarily as an adaptation, but because of genetic linkages. And so the upright walking of the human being and the shape of the head and neck and jaw corresponded to the enlarging of the brain cavity, and it also corresponded to the development of the vocal apparatus. And so all of these changes in the structure of the human being seem to be related and suited to a common development that we know of as the human being. And language happened at about that time as well. So we're speaking about the last 200,000 years, basically, and that movement culminated about 40,000 years ago. And at that point, all the apparatus for speech, the large brain, the flexible, upright spine had taken place. 200,000 years is a pretty good time span, I think, in evolutionary terms. If you think about the lion and the cow, if we can think about cowness and lionness and giraffeness, these guys came along with us, you know, relatively recently during the later mammalian evolution, and they're all pretty distinct. All of us guys that evolved in the last 50 million years, let's say, have a lot of similarities. and each is quite distinct. So it takes a good amount of time for a species, a complex species, to evolve, but once it does, it's pretty unique, and it has carved out for itself a niche which lasts it for a long time. Lionness and cowness happen to work very well together. One eats the grass and the other one eats the grass eater, and their numbers and their sizes and their metabolism and their habitats are all nicely balanced so that both can live happily for thousands and hundreds of thousands of years. When this kind of evolutionary thinking had been well digested around the first decade of the 20th century, human beings who were thinking about these things realized that our history and our culture and our way of thinking really distinguishes us quite radically from the other mammal species. In many ways we are the same. And I've invited you a number of times to spend contemplative quality time relating to some lower level species who are related to us and in whom we can observe many of our traits. So in many ways we're closely connected to that phyletic order of things. But one of the key movements in evolutionary theory and philosophy of evolution, which took place in the first decade of the 20th century, was reflection upon the abstractness and disassociation that our knowledge creates between us and those others with whom we are closely connected, actually. All of this knowledge that we have of species and classes and patterns of adaptation and variation and connectedness, these concepts are in themselves adequate for a certain kind of knowing, and at the same time there's another way of knowing nature that we sometimes experience, in which we actually know the entity itself in a much more complex way. And we use the example of the dog or the horse, whose emotions we become sensitive to, whose intelligence we begin to appreciate, and we are amazed sometimes by that uniqueness and wonder that is embodied in another species. not to mention our own members of our own species, whose uniqueness is unbounded. I mean, whose differences and therefore uniqueness is infinite. And so we come up against a limitation in our thinking, which tends to understand wholes. And so then this kind of reflection leads to a certain kind of epistemological understanding. We think in terms of stable, eternal, unchanging entities. The lion, the cow, the human psychology, this pattern and that pattern. We make just enough observations to be able to generalize. And then we know something. That kind of knowledge enables us to accomplish certain things. It enables us to breed better strains of cows and rice and such things. It enables us to recognize and treat certain kinds of diseases, abnormalities. It enables us to understand a phenomenon like language in this way, or a phenomenon like sight in this way, scientifically. We know that the faculty of sight has evolved independently in 40 different lines, phyletic lines, without sight is omnipresent, the faculty of sight is omnipresent in the animal world. From the microbe, I mean from the paramecium to the human being, sight is omnipresent. And in human beings, language is omnipresent. And so all human beings, whatever their cultural origins, whatever their time period in history, have developed this most extraordinary thing called language, which we can understand and describe incrementally in the way that Vladimir has been describing it to us. This linguistic science is very thorough and true. But compare that understanding with the phenomenon of language itself. This phenomenon that occurs universally in the human species that enables communication to be understood, to work, but not only is it its utility, it's what it is that is so remarkable. There is nothing else like language. It is a power of consciousness. There's nothing else like a giraffe or a lion. The evolution of these entities has undoubtedly followed a certain line of process. So natural selection works, and it goes on in language development as well. But language is so extraordinarily different from anything that we know of that's happening in the cells of the body, in the neurons, it's like different worlds. But our mind just sails along on this track of generalization, and so we create a science of language just like we create a science of mammals and plants and other classes and orders of things, and we use them effectively for our purposes, these sciences that we create. And something strange happens. We lose contact with the existential quality of the thing itself. It becomes reduced to formulas, and the mental formulations take on the quality of reality. And we believe that we are actually speaking about language, or we're actually speaking about the evolution of species. So this awareness struck philosophers first around 1910. And I have just recently discovered that probably the most germinal philosophical discovery took place in the mind of a man named Henri Bergson. From his ideas, as we will see in a moment, from his ideas grew a wide range of exploration of consciousness. Many fields developed, and along the lines that he began to explore. Not that he can be given credit for all of those things, I'm not implying that, but there was a mind there who penetrated this barrier of rational adequacy that had evolved over the past 2,000 years or so, quite happily. And he realized what was happening. And so he analyzed it, he stated it, and he attempted to move beyond it, the limitations of the rational scientific way of thinking and speaking. So I gave you a handout which is taken from the last section of the last chapter of his book called Creative Evolution. And I strongly encourage you to read that, because even though the language is philosophical and it's based upon an understanding of 400 or 500 years of philosophical thought, which is quite a continuous stream of thinking, from Descartes and Hume to Husserl, you know, it's quite and Nietzsche and Schelling and the whole sort of Western philosophical development is in the background of what he says. But he just picks out certain key ideas in these different developments of thought in order to illustrate their limitations. And he notices that the fundamental problem of the rational mind in coming to terms with the world in which it is grounded is a certain perception of time. And he traces this idea all the way back to the beginnings of philosophy. And in that time, in the beginnings of traditional philosophy, you have close similarities between Eastern and Western thinking, actually. And so he shows in a very systematic way how our tendency is to, the mind's tendency, the rational mind's tendency, is to think like film thinks. We observe a sequence of events and we capture a certain frame, a certain image, which represents to us that process that we observe. And we hold on to that, we consider that unit the thing, the reality. And you can see this especially in Aristotle, where the whole philosophy of time and space and evolution, psychology, everything is treated in terms of two principles, form and matter. And the form is the thing we know, and matter is the thing that's changing all the time, making the forms. And so the Greeks determined that the form is the essence. So when we know about Greek civilization, the period of Plato and Aristotle and Alexander the Great and so on, we know that Plato represents a certain quite amazing compendium of philosophical thinking that has influenced our civilization every day, every year, during every epoch. And we know that Alexander the Great began this movement of empire, and we're still living with it, with its effects. And it went through several generations. And this knowledge is wonderful. Now, what do we really know about Alexander's conquests and the spirit with which he led and organized and the impact that that had, that spirit, that power, the impact that it had on succeeding generations in terms of agriculture or language, or philosophy, or anything else. And what do we really know about any of that which happened 2,500 years ago? No. We don't know very much about it. So we have a capacity for generalizing. And it serves us well for certain purposes. But it doesn't give us real, intimate knowledge of the temporal movement. It gives us a cinematographical frame which represents the temporal movement. We are engaged now in time. This time-space continuum that brings us back here every week and that right now has us listening and speaking, this energy that is happening right now that is formulating a certain view of history and a certain philosophy of understanding, a kind of epistemology, this understanding is taking place in a specific space-time continuum. And you are going to capture a few ideas and phrases and take them with you. And when you read Bergson, you're going to see some of the same ideas and phrases that will reinforce a certain kind of understanding that is grounded in a certain kind of time a kind of temporal consciousness that we have. Our consciousness is limited by a certain way of understanding time. And we find it very easy and convenient to measure time in a kind of artificial way, minutes and quarter hours and hours and days, and we think that things are happening in those frames. But actually these things are just continue happening all the time. And so I continue thinking about these things, and I planned all of this for last week, and I don't even remember what it was, which was supposed to happen last week. But it's one continuous thinking process that I have tuned into with the help of Bergson, who tuned into it with the help of Nietzsche and Spinoza and Aristotle. And Bergson said, and he's known mainly for this, that the way reality actually unfolds, the reality of the world, is that each of these things which we think about in terms of ideas and forms takes place in a kind of time that endures. It's an enduring which actually happens. This that we are doing now has a duration. The kind of understanding that we will eventually reach has a duration. The amount, the kind of energy that was present when the species that we're most familiar with over 50 million years evolved, the way the lion changed from a very small to a very large to finally a reasonable size. This lion entity evolved incrementally over tens of millions of years. What the picture that Darwin has shown us is of a descent of species which has taken place over a time period of 3 billion years. And every moment of that time is related to every other moment. The genetic development of species in their vast interconnectedness could only happen as a result of exactly the amount of time that it took for those things to happen. And so Sri Aurobindo in Savitri speaks about time as the will of the divine. So Bergson asks us to think about the possibility of knowing things directly in terms of their own duration. To know things by putting ourselves in the stream of time, actual time. So as an experiment, we can do this. We can put ourselves in relation to a person or an animal, not for the sake of repeating and reproducing the common understanding that we have of each other already, the knowledge that we have, and put ourselves in relationship with a dog or a cat or a bird or a forest, for that matter, with the idea that we might enter into the stream of time which is the duration of each entity. And Bergson says many amazing things about the possibility of such knowing. First of all, he calls it intuition. And he says that there must be a physical intuition and a vital intuition and a mental intuition and a what he calls supra-conscious intuition. Which, if we could enter into, would replace our rational mode of knowing with a knowing of being. And we would forget about our grand reified images of how things are, and we would know exactly how things are in themselves. And he shows how Kant missed the track just a bit, and he shows how Spinoza missed the track just a bit, but it was there. He was looking at it, but he didn't quite get it. And so on, he explains very clearly how Plato and Aristotle came to their philosophy of forms. And it makes perfectly good sense, and it leads to a kind of metaphysical way of understanding things. So he says, on the flux itself of duration, science neither would nor could lay hold. Scientific thinking cannot lay hold of the actual flux of duration. It requires another knowing, and it's one that's natural to us also. We are grounded in the physical and the vital and the mental and the psychic. And so we can enter into that way of knowing naturally. And of course you'll begin to see the similarities with many of Sri Aurobindo's ideas. And if you know the work of Jean Gebser, you will see the connection with many of his ideas. And if you know the work of Martin Heidegger, you will see the connection with many of his ideas. It's extraordinary how many streams of human advancement grew out of these fundamental perceptions. So he says this second kind of knowledge would have set the cinematographical method aside. It would have called upon the mind to renounce its most cherished habits. It is within becoming that it would have transported us by an effort of sympathy. We should no longer be asking where a moving body will be, what shape a system will take, through what state a change will pass at a given moment. The moments of time which are only arrests of our attention. Time itself doesn't stop. We don't stop changing. Change doesn't stop happening just because we hit upon an idea about something at a certain point. Aha! The moments of time would no longer exist. The moments of time would no longer exist. Time doesn't have moments. We have moments. So Gebser, when Gebser in the 40s writes his book called The Ever-Present Origin, the whole vision of which he attributes to Sri Aurobindo subsequently, he writes a psychological interpretation of the evolution of human consciousness, a psychological interpretation based upon time perception. And he understands that the integral consciousness, the new mutation, will be characterized primarily by a change in the way we perceive time. And he shows how the whole 20th century, in its art, in its science, in its philosophy, in its psychology, is based upon a shifting perception of time. It is the flow of time, it is the very flux of the real that we should be trying to follow. The first kind of knowledge, the rational, has the advantage of enabling us to foresee the future and of making us in some measure masters of events. In return, it retains of the moving reality only eventual immobilities. That is to say, views taken of it by our mind. The other knowledge, if it is possible, is practically useless. It will not extend our empire over nature. It will even go against certain natural aspirations of the intellect. But if it succeeds, it is reality itself that it will hold in a firm and final embrace. Not only may we thus complete the intellect and its knowledge of matter by accustoming it to install itself within the moving, but by developing also another faculty, complementary to the intellect, we may open a perspective on the other half of the real. For as soon as we are confronted with true duration, we see that it means creation. That if that which is being unmade endures, it can only be because it is inseparably bound to what is making itself. And so Sheldrake writes a book in 1995 called The Presence of the Past, a book about biological evolution. It's for sale in all the bookstores in Pondicherry. It's been taken by this new publishing house that is copying all the good books available in the West and making them available in India. So all of Sheldrake's books are there in Focus, in Vak, in everywhere.
Landmark online?
Probably, yeah. No, no, it's an Indian publisher, so they're there. So Sheldrake has given a very interesting synthesis of philosophy and biology in this book called The Presence of the Past. It's very similar to what I'm trying to do here. Thus will appear the necessity of a continual growth of the universe. Thus will appear the necessity of the continual growth of the universe. I should say of a life of the real. And thus will be seen in a new light the life which we find on the surface of our planet. A life directed the same way as that of the universe. And inverse of materiality. To intellect, in short, there will be added intuition. Now, I would like to, so there are a couple of things for us to notice. As a result of this shift, which began in around this time, first decade of the 20th century, there grew up the whole field of anthropology and the study of mind as an evolutionary phenomenon. And so in Gebser, for example, we get the idea that there was a period of human evolution which was characterized by a kind of mind that he calls the archaic, and then subsequently a kind of mind which he calls the magical, and then a kind of mind which he calls the mythical, and then a kind of mind that he calls the rational, and ultimately the emergence of a new kind of mind that he calls the integral. If we read The Life Divine, we see Sri Aurobindo speaking about exactly the same stages of the evolution of mind, especially in the chapter called Man and the Evolution. Then we have a phrase that we find in hope that I picked that phrase up. Well, never mind. You'll see it in your printout. Then we have another stream of thinking, as I said, the stream of phenomenology, which is based upon the idea for which Heidegger deserves the credit primarily, of the necessity of, well, his book was called Being and Time, the necessity of giving up the way of thinking that is logical and rational and learning to think being as such. And this is a shift from epistemology to ontology, from the philosophy of how we know to the philosophy of what is. And we will see that in the 20th century there is one major movement of philosophy that represents this shift from epistemology, which characterized all of the 17th and 18th and 19th century, to ontology. What is? Not what do we think, not what do we know, not what do we understand, not why do we think the way we do, and on and on and on, what conditions our way of thinking, but what is? What is reality? We can know. It's not true that we have to impose an interpretation on everything and then call that knowledge. We can actually know things directly, wholly, holistically. So the whole movement of psychology in the 20th century, the discovery of the unconscious and its relationship to the conscious and to the superconscious, is about coming to terms with our groundedness in all the levels of reality and getting out of this idea of being on the surface of everything and knowing how to manipulate it. So all of these developments in 20th century thought, these most important developments in human thinking and being, stem from certain fundamental perceptions, a certain grasp. Heidegger had a certain grasp of reality that enabled him to shake the foundations of Western philosophy to the root. Sri Aurobindo had a certain grasp of reality that enabled him to push the evolution of consciousness in another direction. And on and on and on. Freud had a grasp of reality that enabled him to overturn the scales of value and judgment and understanding of what the human being is. So, just to emphasize the extraordinary quality of Bergson's thinking, I took out a few selections from the very end, or close to the end of his book. His thinking that leads up to these observations is quite detailed and interesting to follow. And then he comes to, if our analysis is correct, it is consciousness, or rather supra-consciousness, that is at the origin of life. Consciousness, or supra-consciousness, is the name for the rocket whose extinguished fragments fall back as matter. Consciousness, again, is the name for that which subsists of the rocket itself, passing through the fragments and lighting them up into organisms. But this consciousness, which is a need of creation, is made manifest to itself only where creation is possible. The whole history of life until man has been that of the effort of consciousness to raise matter, and of the more or less complete overwhelming of consciousness by the matter which has fallen back on it. The enterprise was paradoxical, if indeed we may speak here otherwise than by metaphor of enterprise and of effort. It was to create with matter, which is necessity itself, an instrument of freedom. To make a machine which should triumph over mechanism. And to use the determinism of nature to pass through the meshes of the net which this very determinism had spread. Everywhere but in man, consciousness has had to come to a stand. In man alone, it has kept on its way. Man, it then, continues the vital movement indefinitely, although he does not draw along with him all that life carries in itself. On other lines of evolution, there have traveled other tendencies which life implied, and of which, since everything interpenetrates, man has, doubtless, kept something, but of which he has kept only very little. It is as if a vague and formless being, whom we may call, as we will, man or Superman, had sought to realize himself, and had succeeded only by abandoning a part of himself on the way. The losses are represented by the rest of the animal world, and even by the vegetable world, at least in what these have that is positive and above the accidents of evolution. This is early 20th century, post-Nietzschean, scientific, metaphysical, theological inspiration, catching a glimpse of the totality. Sri Aurobindo takes all of these ideas to their higher range, but they're the same ideas. These fleeting intuitions, which light up their object only at distant intervals, philosophy ought to seize, first to sustain them, then to expand them, and so unite them together. The more it advances in this work, the more will it perceive that intuition is mind itself, and in a certain sense, life itself. The intellect has been cut out of it by a process resembling that which has generated matter. Thus is revealed the unity of the spiritual life. We recognize it only when we place ourselves in intuition in order to go from intuition to the intellect. For from the intellect we shall never pass to intuition. Philosophy introduces us thus into the spiritual life, and it shows us at the same time the relation of the life of the spirit to that of the body. Life as a whole, from the initial impulsion that thrust it into the world, will appear as a wave which rises and which is opposed by the descending movement of matter. Now, in order to appreciate this for what it is, we have to step out of our customary framework of metaphors in the Sri Aurobindo school of thinking. We have to step out just a little bit, because we find that in all of these philosophers of evolution, there is an idea of descent and ascent. All of them have it, from Darwin up to the present time. But the way they formulate their system is unique in each one of them. And so this idea of matter descending and consciousness rising is the metaphor that Bergson grasped in order to convey the idea that spirit and matter are co-evolving. On the other hand, this rising wave is consciousness. And like all consciousness, it includes potentialities without number, which interpenetrate and to which consequently neither the category of unity nor that of multiplicity is appropriate, made as they both are for inert matter. Our concept of unity and of multiplicity is based upon a certain kind of physical consciousness. The matter that it bears along with it, and in the interstices of which it inserts itself, alone can divide it. This matter alone can divide consciousness into distinct individualities. This concept of individualization is what characterizes this stage of human evolution, whether you think of it in terms of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy or Jung's philosophy or anyone else's, Gebser's. But it is also there in the idea of species becoming more and more individualized. The more and more complex they become, the more conscious they become, the more individualized they become in relation to other species. Finally, consciousness is essentially free. It is freedom itself. But it cannot pass through matter without settling on it, without adapting itself to it. Later on, we see the idea that it actually is already in it. But then the idea of consciousness emerging in matter can also easily be seen as a relationship between necessity and freedom, and resulting in form and change, and the particular coincidence of form and change, matter and spirit, equals form and change. Finally, consciousness is essentially free. It is freedom itself, but it cannot pass through matter without settling on it, without adapting itself to it. All the living hold together, and all yield to the same tremendous push. Now, we have to have this question, we have to hold this question when we look back over evolution, and we realize that we cannot understand anything really. But what we do understand is that it has moved continuously for 3 billion years, and it is still moving, even though it looks like it's not moving most of the time. But because we can look back at the genetic record and the fossil record and the geological record and all of these things almost to the day, we know that it's moving. And we have to ask ourselves, what is it that is moving? What is moving? Because it never stays put. 99.9 species that have ever existed are extinct today. Many more that exist today are becoming extinct daily, and our own extinction is imminent. But evolution just keeps moving. And so we have to ask the question at some point, what is it that is moving? Okay? Then our friend Bergson takes the big leap. All the living hold together and all yield to the same tremendous push. The animal takes its stand on the plant, man bestrides animality, and the whole of humanity in space and in time is one immense army galloping beside and before and behind each of us in an overwhelming charge, able to beat down every resistance, don't we hope, and clear the most formidable obstacles, perhaps even death. 1907.
Question. There's one statement which I would be happy if you could explain to it. You're fine just the way you were. Something about intuition not passing nature. For intuition not to pass to the. For the intuition
yeah.
not passing to intuition.
Yeah. Okay. You don't need to understand it. Done. And I don't need to understand it, and no one needs to understand it. It's a Bergsonism. But you can interpret it. He can interpret it. I can interpret it. But it's only when you engage with a philosopher intimately that you can grasp what he means. And every philosopher that I've read so far means something quite unique. And this is the wonder of philosophy. And it's the wonder of sight. And it's the wonder of language. That this creativity that comes to a level of maximization of potential, a work of art, a composition, a work of philosophy, a poem, a real poem, has a meaning and a uniqueness based upon a consciousness which is the product of a process that is itself. So, aside from that, we could speculate about what he means. And we can easily also just move away from it into Sri Aurobindo's psychology, and we can understand that what he calls intuitive mind is not something that happens inside our head at all. It's a plane of reality, like life and matter. And that plane of reality, that intuitive plane, is a subplane of the overmind, and reality is condensing itself into more and more individualized units from that plane of pure principle where everything is known by everything else. So obviously you cannot move from rational human mind to that without a big evolutionary change. And so I think that the hint that Bergson is catching here, and that Heidegger caught, and that Gebser caught, the hint is, and that Sri Aurobindo really capitalized upon, is that a change of consciousness is what's required, and it can't happen without silencing completely the mind. Because that other consciousness is not mental.
That means evolution is acceptance of another brain.
Human evolution, yeah. You mean? Yeah, so good that you say that, because yes, human evolution means moving beyond the human. So what philosophy does very well is, especially the philosophy that we know of in the 18th, 19th, and 20th century, its main project is to understand what it means to be a human being. That's what Kant wrote about, that's what Hume wrote about, that's what Nietzsche wrote about, that's what Bergson writes about. Philosophy is the study of the meaning of being human, and especially mental, rational, conscious being. And it has understood it completely, and so then in the 60s, Heidegger popped out a nice little tract called The End of Philosophy. Because this new consciousness, this consciousness, this direct consciousness of being itself, is also an energy of being. It's another way of being. And it doesn't need rationality. Rationality is needed to understand its necessity. But then it has to abdicate. And Sri Aurobindo and the mother both use this word quite liberally, abdication of the mind. But it can only abdicate when it is really poised and knows that for which it abdicates. And so in that chapter called Man and the Evolution, there are two pages face to face around 846 or so. These were pages written in 1940, where Sri Aurobindo says there's a double evolution going on. There is the evolution in the three worlds, mind, life, and body, and there is the spiritual evolution going on. And for the evolution of the mind, life, and body, it is essential to take the evolution of the mind to its absolute limit, while at the same time, the spiritual evolution is going on all the time and has always been going on within the three world complex, the triple world complex. And it can step out at any point and realize the absolute, the spiritual truth. But for it to manifest itself in the context of the threefold evolution, it can't do that. It can only temporarily step out in order to get some leverage. And then it's back in. And it's an in and out kind of process, up and down. In and out, the double evolutionary path. So he carries this way of thinking into the road. Bergson is catching a glimpse of the path. And Sri Aurobindo is going full blast on the road. Especially in 1940. You know, he added 14 new chapters, or 16 new chapters, to The Life Divine in 1939-40, and revised a lot of the rest, a lot of the earlier chapters. So that book didn't actually see the light of day until 1940. And in 1944 was its complete. He was still writing in the margins. So the fact that his book became published in New York and in India in the middle 40s, and by 1950 was pretty well known all over the world, is another one of those amazing phenomena of the life of Sri Aurobindo. But if you will notice, those last 14 chapters, half of them have the word evolution in the title. And this is the theme that he is pumping with every ounce of energy that he is able to bring down from that higher consciousness. So was Whitehead, and so was Bergson, and so was Gebser, and there were many along the way who, around 1940, 1950, 1960, Conrad Lorenz, 1970, just really tuned in to the universal thought process of evolution. Evolution is now thinking. Sri Aurobindo said that evolution itself would evolve. Now, evolution, as the Huxleys said in 1890 and 1910, you know, Thomas, Henry, and Julian, as they said back then, now evolution is mental. It's not biological anymore. The biological evolution just gets pulled along. But where it's really happening is in the mind, in the culture, in the systems. Sri Aurobindo says the same thing. And once the spiritual evolution takes place, he says, then all the rest can be elevated to another type. And yes, there is a point where it's necessary to step out completely from the pattern, the rational pattern, and enter the silence and the emptiness, but with a firm hold on the flame. It's not the old stepping out into the ultimate emptiness. So that was his yogic movement based upon this understanding, which was taken to its limits. By the way, I have to stop at 6:45.
People would say, I hear Dylan Thurber's reading his poetry, that sense of reality, another super violent reality.
Yeah, and he stepped into that vital, physical, direct connection, and he wrote from that in an extraordinary way. He was also completely drunk most of the time, but he had this knack of being able to be conscious at the same time that he was totally loaded, and so he was able to write poetry of an extraordinary vibrancy and power,
and
read it too.
Yeah.
So this is not just theoretical. People are discovering the truth and trying to live by it at whatever level they happen to be living. R.D. Lang, when he enters into therapy, he learns how to identify himself completely with his patient, and he just lets himself go completely into his patient's syndrome, and he works inside there. There was a whole school of psychology in the 60s and 70s that did that, and probably still does it. So the emergence of this new consciousness is an evolutionary phenomenon. The utilization of it in designing structures is very new and very clumsy, as we can see every day in Oregon. Okay. What I had been planning to do in this session is just sit in a circle and begin to philosophize a bit. So we're getting close to that point where we've got all the ammunition. I want to, in addition to that handout from last time, which I do hope you'll find time to read, I know it's difficult, but it's worthwhile. I also want to give you a chart from this book, The Ever-Present Origin, which we can talk about next time. But it'll just start you thinking about the kinds of minds that have evolved since during the last 10,000 years. And what characterizes each of them. And you can begin to identify a bit with what in us, they're all still there in us, what in us is still carrying the archaic, and what is still carrying the magical and the mythical and the rational, and how do they manifest in our own behaviors and beliefs and ways of functioning. And then out of this grows integral psychology, which is a new field. Only a few people working in that field so far. So I have 15 of these.